Well, as you just heard, I teach a course, Catholic Intellectual Tradition. And I'm an expert on late medieval and early modern history. So what I'm about to say to you is largely a meditation on a large subject. It's not really a scholarly paper, but it's meditation on the subject at hand. And I have to begin with an anecdote, which is very germane to what we just heard, the transformation of the university into something else. When I became chair of the Religious Studies Department at Yale, what happens is the president calls you into the office and offers you the position and so on. The first question he asked me, this is many years ago, this is 1999, President Levin asked me, why do we teach theology in Yale College? The question was asked in a way that, you could tell. It wasn't a philosophical question. It was basically a complaint, like maybe when you're chair of the department, you can take care of this problem and do away with that. I gave him a historical answer. I regretted doing that afterwards. But anyway, as you just heard, I published a very big book, 900-page book, on religious changes in early modern Europe. And the book is so large that readers complain about how much it weighs. But nonetheless, I fear this task of providing a survey of the issue, the place of the Catholic intellectual tradition at a secular university. Writing history is one thing, dissecting the present is quite another. And when it comes to this particular topic, I have to say I find kinship with J.R.R. Tolkien, who said in his valedictory address at the end of his career at Oxford, and I quote, "The diagnosis of what is wrong and the confident prescription of the cure, the wide view, the masterly survey, plans and prophecies, these have never been in my line." Nonetheless, as someone who teaches a course, survey course, in the Catholic intellectual tradition, 20 centuries in one semester, I suppose there are some observations I can make about this and offer some oblique diagnosis of things that, quote unquote, are wrong in our world. And I can do this as long as I can avoid the perils of making, quote-unquote, confident prescriptions or offering up plans and prophecies. As you will see soon enough at the tail end of my talk, I will leave those tasks to someone else that everyone in this room knows. Many, if not most, of the students who take my Catholic intellectual tradition course, which I co-teach with two colleagues, many of them, if not most, are Catholic. But not all of them are. But after 5 years of engaging with Catholic students in this course, it has become very, very clear to me, painfully clear, that most of them, even those who have attended Catholic schools from kindergarten through 12th grade, are unaware of the rational thought that shapes their faith. Or conversely, how their faith shapes their own thinking. Which means that at a very fundamental level, there is not as much of a difference as one might expect between Catholics and non-Catholics who enroll in a Catholic intellectual tradition course at a secular university. And Yale is a secular university. I have also discovered that by posing some very basic questions, this lack of awareness can be overcome. What does it mean to believe? What is the role of reason in faith? What does it mean for Catholics to think about what they believe, or how they worship, or how they are supposed to behave? How have Catholics carried on this search for understanding over the past 20 centuries? What difference does all of this thinking make? What relation should present-day Catholics have with all of that thinking, which is a lot? too much for any one person. And what does all this thinking have to offer to our secular civilization? Well, Flannery O'Connor, one of my favorite authors, expressed the conundrum at the heart of the Catholic intellectual tradition in a very unique way, as only she could, through one of her characters in the book, novella, Wise Blood, through the character of Hazel Mokes. And I'll quote to you Hazel Mokes. I preach the church without Christ. A member and preacher to that church where the blind don't see, the lame don't walk, and what's dead stays that way. Ask me about the church and I'll tell you, the church, the blood of Jesus, don't foul with redemption. Exact opposite of Luke 7:22. Go your way. Tell John what things you have seen or heard. How the blind see, the lame walk, the lepers are cleansed, the deaf hear, the dead are raised, and to the poor, the gospel is preached. Hazel Mokes, a 20th century man, invented by a 20th century Catholic who lived in, of all places, Milledgeville, Georgia. Hazel Mokes, 20th century man who doesn't see any dead people rising from the grave, lame people being healed, blind people being made to see. Hazel Mokes poses the essential question for any Christian, not just any Catholic, but any Christian who dares to think about what they believe. The troublesome question at the heart of the Catholic intellectual tradition. How to think about what one believes. And what one believes includes so much that one does not see. How can one square one's reason, one's experience in the so-called real world, with one's faith in things unseen? How can one reconcile things that seem diametrically opposed? The profane and the sacred, the earthly and the divine, reason and faith, mind and soul. Or to paraphrase Tertullian, what do university laboratories and libraries have to do with the university chapel? Or what does New Haven have to do with Jerusalem? And there's an essential dialectic faced by Catholics at any university, Catholic or secular, a dialectic between the mass and class assignments. But the dialectic tends to be more acute at a secular university, where there may or may not be a Catholic chapel. Focusing on chapels as a sacred spot in a secular landscape can be instructive. How does the sacred relate to the secular? O'Connor's, or Hazel Mokes' Church Without Christ offers us a clue. O'Connor, in Milledgeville, Georgia, was surrounded by anti-Catholic sentiment. But she built a chapel, nonetheless, in a most unlikely place in her books, which are suffused with a sense of the sacred. Faith claims a place within reason. Reason claims a place within faith. All faith encounters occur in time and space, in some place or locus, in a very specific landscape. The earth is full of unlikely places for these encounters. Abraham and Isaac, Mount Moriah, Moses on Mount Sinai, St. Paul on the road to Damascus, Augustine at the garden, Ignatius Loyola in his room recovering from the cannonball wound that almost made him lose his leg, Maximilian Kolbe at Auschwitz, and Flannery O'Connor in Milledgeville. Catholic students at a secular university. Catholic students at a Catholic university. There's the real problem sometimes. Catholic chapels at universities are avatars of the reason-faith dialectic. That's what I'm proposing. And Catholics, boy, Catholics build chapels of all sorts. We sacralize space, for faith is for us not merely some unseen interior realm. It's much more than an attitude or hope or an assertion of beliefs. Faith is an encounter with the sacred and divine, an affirmation of the physical presence of the divine. We build chapels to gather in, buildings. But when Catholics gather, it's not merely for fellowship, important as that is, but it is to encounter the sacred in the here and now, in the place, in the locus, to affirm the intersection of heaven and earth, faith and reason. We also build chapels within churches, spaces in which to encounter specific, intimate manifestations of the sacred. We build other sorts of chapels, too. Space at work, at home, or in a prison cell. Like O'Connor, we can fill our work with the presence of the sacred. We can build chapels within ourselves, the so-called quote-unquote inner cell, described by Catherine of Siena in the 14th century. Chapel, by the way, has a strange etymology. I looked it up because I was curious, and it's from the capella, or coat, worn by St. Martin of Tours, which was enshrined by the Frankish kings, and the place where it was enshrined came to be known as the capella, or chapel. So what does that show us? It shows us the importance of place and being. But the other word which it replaced was oratory. The little prayer spaces, which now are known mostly as chapels. And what does this tell us? It tells us that prayer, then, is a key. Chapels are places of prayer. And as the etymology shows us, prayer sacralizes space, and in space, in turn, becomes an oratory or a chapel. It becomes sacred. We can sacralize space, and the space is at once sacred and perhaps also profane. We need buildings consecrated to the sacred. Catholics do. But then, no, we don't need them either. We desperately need them, but we can do without them. And this is the core of what we explore in the Catholic Intellectual Tradition course. Paradox, the essential paradox, and the many, many essential paradoxes at the center of faith. Paradoxes that our reason cannot plumb. This paradoxical ambivalence, which is the essence of the Catholic faith, also necessarily center of the Catholic intellectual tradition. It's not an uneasy ambivalence, because the Catholic intellectual tradition embraces binaries of all sorts. And I don't want to distract you with writing on the board, but the most important binaries are either or and both and. And the Catholic intellectual tradition is comfortable with both of those, depending on what the subject is that one is dealing with. Either or, definitely, there is only one God. But the both and, Catholic intellectual tradition is not only comfortable, it revels in the both and. So, we have one God, three persons. We have a Savior who is divine and human. The coincidence of opposites, as Nicholas of Cusa pointed out repeatedly, is central. The paradox is central to belief and to Christian reasoning. And one could say also, of course, Catholic reasoning. What are some of these paradoxes that make up the Catholic intellectual tradition? And this is what we have, the three of us teach this course, that constantly remind our students to put aside their linear thinking for a while. Transcendence and immanence, past, present, and future. The divine human in Christ. The Virgin and the Mother in Jesus' Mother. Free will and grace. This drives to students absolutely insane. Free will and election. The Council of Trent pronounces, yes, there is predestination. And yes, there is free will. Just don't claim that you're one of the predestined. That's the warning. No one should claim that they are sure that they are one of the predestined. But there's both free will and predestination. The saints who are always sinner. St. Teresa of Avila's final words and her deathbed. I am the greatest sinner ever. A church that's the same, a tradition that's always the same, but always evolving. Church in which there is plenty of authority and plenty of obedience is required, that is at once conservative and anti-establishment or even countercultural, as Francis of Assisi would say. And then Catholic intellectual tradition deals with multiple dimensions all at the same time. The local and the universal, the here and the everywhere, the then, now, and the forever, the liminal and the central, the collective and the individual, the hierarchical, and the social. And affirmation and denial. Got a creed. Catholic tradition has a creed. The creed was formulated in opposition to error. Here's an interesting story I didn't plan to put in my talk, but it's instructive. My first teaching job at St. John's University in Minnesota, I was teaching at the School of Theology, the seminary. We were training Catholic clergy. And I noticed that there was no history of the church or history of Christianity or history of Catholic theology survey. So I asked the dean, who was himself Benedictine priest, please, can we insert this course into the curriculum? And he said, no. This is 1979, okay? We're only interested in what's happening now. We don't need that. We're interested in what's happening now. So having had a Jesuit education, I came back to him in a couple of months later, and I said, you know what we really need is a course in the history of heresy. And he said, yes. So I got to teach the history of Christian doctrine backwards from the heresies. Right? Our creed is nothing but a long list of affirmations of positive things to believe that were formulated in response to what was conceived of as wrong. So, anyway. And before I go any further, I love this. I found this too while preparing the talk. I'll come circle back to this towards the end. We all know there's Catholic with a capital C and Catholic with a small c. Catholic Church means the universal church, universal, general. But this is one of the definitions in Webster's dictionary, which took me aback. But I think needs to be meditated upon. Comprehensive or very broad in sympathies, understanding, appreciation, or interest. Not narrow, isolated, provincial, or partisan. Of course, that's Catholic with small c. Let's circle around to the large C Catholic concerning this issue. As a world religion, among world religions, Roman Catholicism and its belief and practice manifests somewhere within the range of its multicolored life some of the features of every religion of the human race. Thus, only the methodology of comparative religion can encompass them all. It's a belief system, a complex institution. It's a tradition. It's a culture. And it's a living organism by its own definition, the body of Christ, the bride of Christ. And it's universal not just in terms of space, but also time, because all the living on earth and the living and the dead form the communion of saints. And we are as close to Tertullian, who was never proclaimed a saint, or anyone else from the third century. We're as close to them as we are to each other in this room. With all of those binary coincidences of opposites guiding our thinking. But what does all of this that I've just been covering have to do with the life of faith at a university, especially a secular university? Nowadays, a secular university can be an unlikely place for faith. Could be an utterly profane space, pervaded by an utterly profane culture. Not a place for belief. And religion considered something inferior, stupid, or even insane. Aggressive atheists such as Hitchens and Dawkins, for instance, argue that only a truly stupid and inferior person can be a believer. And in the Princeton Review Guide to Colleges, there used to be, when my kids were looking at schools, it may no longer be there, but there was a category of schools were, quote unquote, God is routinely ignored. In the classroom, we're required to be impartial, even to our own beliefs. Toleration and respect of others demands that faith be purely private. Nothing is wrong with that. In fact, it is admirable. In many ways, this may be preferable to an atmosphere where belief goes unquestioned. As the unexamined life is not worth living, so is the unquestioned faith. The unquestioned faith is not real faith. And that, too, is essential to the Catholic intellectual tradition. Questioning is part of St. Anselm's Fides Querens Intellectum. Today is his feast day. Faith seeking understanding. Or Bernard of Clairvaux's Anima Querens Verbum, soul seeking the Word. And sometimes in history of theology, these two are presented to us as opposites of some sort, but they're not. They're different formulations of the same phenomenon. Catholic intellectual tradition is all about questioning faith. Thomas Aquinas' Summas are full of questioning. They're also full of answers. And there you go. There's another binary. There's also the story, apocryphal, of Augustine at the seashore trying to figure out the Trinity while he was working on his great book on the Trinity. Suddenly he sees a little boy digging in the sand with a seashell. Many of you might be familiar with the story. And the little boy runs to the sea, puts a little water in the shell, and then tries to fill the hole. He's doing this many, many times. And Augustine observes him. Finally, he asks him, what are you doing? And the little boy says, well, I'm trying to put all that water out there into this hole here. And Augustine says, basically, in some way, I can't remember the exact text of this apocryphal story, well, that's pretty stupid. You're not going to be able to do that. And the boy responds, well, you know what? I can get all that water in here much more easily than you could ever figure out the Trinity. And poof, then he disappears. Because he was an angel. If that doesn't... I love metaphors. I love images. If that doesn't summarize the Catholic intellectual tradition almost perfectly, I don't know what else can. But what tends to be wrong in the secular environment is the mocking of faith, distrust of faith. Should believers be allowed to teach in religious studies department? Questions that are actually raised and have been raised. What are the faithful to do? Gather in their chapels, their buildings, first and foremost, to encounter the sacred, to recharge, to see that faith is at once inside and invisible and outside and very visible. There are others besides oneself. There's always the university chapel. Second, to carry a chapel inside, bring it wherever you go, prayer and work. To sanctify the mundane with our prayer and behavior, perhaps even to make room for intellectual discussion of faith outside the classroom. At bottom, the most profound Catholic conviction is this: many mysteries are beyond reason, but ultimately, in boldface, there can be no contradiction between faith and reason. God can be encountered in the here and now in innumerable ways, as much in the college chapel as in the laboratory or the sickbed during flu season. As Hugh of St. Victor said, and apropos, this also relates to the first wonderful talk we heard today. Learn everything. Later, you will see nothing is superfluous. And that includes, of course, the whole physical material world. Ultimately, it pays to return repeatedly to the communal chapel, the sacred space that reminds all who pass by of the presence of the divine among us. It's there, it's in that space that Hugh of St. Victor's aphorism can begin to make sense, in that space that faith and reason converge, that everything makes sense. Everything. And it does so especially through ritual. Symbols and rituals reveal the truth at deeper levels. We are thinking beings. Perhaps even consider ourselves intellectuals, but we are much more than that. We need to intuit deeper truths through different means. And that, too, is part of the Catholic intellectual tradition, the way in which myth, theology, ritual, and symbol are interdependent, absolutely interdependent, inescapable interdependence. Because human beings understand truths through the symbolic at a different level. Here, and metaphorically, here. Or as Pascal said, the heart has its reasons, which reason cannot understand. Abbot Suger, 11th century, 12th century, knew what he was talking about 900 years ago, when he built the chapel of Saint-Denis, just outside of Paris, confident in the transparency of symbols and their ability to communicate higher, eternal realities. He said, and I quote this somewhat lengthy quote, "Thus sometimes, when because of my delight in the beauty of the house of God, the multicolored loveliness of the gems has carried me away from external cares and worthy meditation, transporting me from material to immaterial things, then I seem to see myself existing on some level, as it were, beyond our earthly one, neither completely in the slime of the earth nor completely in the purity of heaven. By the gift of God, I can be transported in an anagogical manner from this inferior level to that superior one." And this is what no summa of theology, no matter how wonderful, can ever convey: the fullness and richness of truth, separate from the symbol and the ritual. Or as the text tells us in Hebrews 11:1, faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. Reason deals with the substance of things we touch, with the evidence of things we see, but faith does more than that. And faith does not need to be blind. In fact, the Catholic intellectual tradition is all about linking the seen and the unseen, about making sense of realities beyond our senses. Catholic faith seeks to transcend time and space constantly, in many ways, and most intensely in the celebration of the sacrament of the Eucharist. Catholic faith also seeks to make sense of that transcendence. Any Catholic who wants to think about his or her faith will find innumerable guides and companions, 2,000 years worth of companionship. But what about non-Catholics at a secular university? What does any course on Catholic intellectual tradition have to offer them, besides a glimpse into an alien faith and an alien way of thinking? And by the way, a course in Catholic intellectual tradition doesn't need to have that title. A professor can be very sneaky, just like I was at St. John's. Call it something else, right? And just be totally, opaque. And just have them in there and then expose the students to the Catholic intellectual tradition without them knowing that that is, at the beginning, by the end of the course, they should know what they have been exposed to. So, what about the non-Catholics at a secular university? A clue is offered by someone very different from Flannery O'Connor, a person I warned you would be hearing from, Pope Benedict XVI, in his Regensburg lecture, delivered on the 12th of September, 2006, at the University of Regensburg, where he had once served as a professor of theology, and the title of the lecture was Faith, Reason, and the University, Memories and Reflections. Central issue of the lecture is the dialectic between faith and reason, and its central concern is what Pope Benedict called the tendency to quote, unquote, and we're back to our first talk, quote, unquote, to exclude the question of God. That's his complaint. This is what has happened at many universities. The question of God is being excluded. Unfortunately, that address by Pope Benedict is best known in secular culture as Pope Benedict's Islamophobic lecture, due to the misinterpretation and rampant misquoting of one brief passage. But at the very beginning of this lecture, Pope Benedict stressed the quote-unquote coherence of faith and reason in the secular university, as he honed in on the uneasy relation between faith and secularity. And I'll quote to you again at length from Pope Benedict. And he makes a reference here to the fact that at Regensburg there were two theological faculties, which is common in Germany, where you have an evangelical or Protestant faculty and a Catholic faculty. So he begins here saying, this university was also very proud of its two theological faculties. It was clear that by inquiring about the reasonableness of faith, they too carried out a work which is necessarily part of the whole of the Universitas Scientarum, even if not everyone could share the faith which theologians seek to correlate with reason as a whole. This profound sense of coherence within the universe of reason was not troubled, even when it was once reported that a colleague had said there was something odd about our university because it had two faculties devoted to something that did not exist, God. That even in the face of such radical skepticism, it is still necessary and reasonable to raise the question of God through the use of reason, and to do so in the context of the tradition of the Christian faith. This, within the university as a whole, was accepted without question. Was, past tense. Pope Benedict's lecture offers everything Tolkien feared to do. Quote, the diagnosis of what is wrong, the confident prescription of the cure, the wide view, the masterly survey, plans and prophecies. His main argument in that lecture is that the Catholic intellectual tradition is an essential component of Western culture and Western values. Christianity is the culmination of the Greek philosophical tradition. The insertion of the Logos, Christ, but the Logos, reason, into Hellenistic thinking. And I quote again from his lecture. This inner rapprochement between biblical faith and Greek philosophical inquiry was an event of decisive importance, not only from the standpoint of the history of religions, but also from that of world history. It is an event which concerns us even today. End quote. The warning, the prophetic dimension of his lecture is this: if Christianity is tossed away by the West, if faith is made incompatible with reason or extrinsic to reason, the West will kill itself. And along with the warning comes a prescription. And I quote again: while we rejoice in new possibilities open to humanity, everything offered to us by modern science and our materialistic perspective on life, we also see the dangers arising from these possibilities, and we must ask ourselves how we can overcome them. We will succeed in doing so only if reason and faith come together in a new way. If we overcome the self-imposed limitation of reason to the empirically falsifiable, and if we once more disclose its vast horizons. In this sense, theology rightly belongs in the university and within the wide-ranging dialogue of sciences, not merely as a historical discipline and one of the human sciences, but precisely as theology, as inquiry into the rationality of faith. Only thus do we become capable of that genuine dialogue of cultures and religions so urgently needed today. End quote. One very important issue Pope Benedict did not address, and that we have no time to address here, is the ultimate worth of Western ethics, which are the practical application of the Catholic intellectual tradition. The faith-reason dialectic is not just about thinking, but about living one's life, building and maintaining a just society, and so on and so on, doing the right thing. And coming toward the end here, most of us are painfully aware of this ethical dimension of the Catholic intellectual tradition, and painfully aware of this aspect of the faith-reason dialectic has created trouble for believers in our day and age. It is the source of all our culture wars in the West and of divisions within the Catholic Church itself, and of the angst created by our secular mechanized environment, so aptly described by Tolkien as an age of, quote, improved means to deteriorated ends. This is where the Catholic, small c, comes into play in Catholic with large C, capital C. Be Catholic is to be tolerant, as Webster's dictionary would have it. Not narrow, isolated, provincial, or partisan. Catholic intellectual tradition accommodates inquiry and differences of opinion, of course, up to a point where the either or comes into play. Can't have three gods. No. No way. Our secular civilization, however, seems headed in the opposite direction insofar as faith and ethics are concerned. I'll close with two anecdotes. It's always good to have anecdotes at the beginning and the end. And they always sum things up. If done correctly, you'll let me know if they don't work. When I was appointed to the Catholic chair at Yale, the Riggs chair, one of my colleagues in the history department, he said, well, why did they give you that chair? Why did you get the Catholic chair? You're not Catholic. I said, but I am. And then my colleague stammered, but you're so tolerant. When my memoir, Waiting for Snow in Havana, after it had won the National Book Award in the United States, went to London, to Scribner's UK. I got back the manuscript. It was completely ripped to shreds by the British editor, reduced by over half, but also had the explicit instructions. Explicit. You must remove every mention of religion from your book. Our British reading public will be turned off by your quote-unquote muscular Christianity. So in my very best muscular American English, I said, fold my book four ways and put it where the moon don't shine. If you're not going to have this in the book, forget it. Well, they took their revenge on me by not doing any publicity. But it was published. But this idea you have to remove religion from a text completely. He also advised me to remove all mention of politics. So basically, he just wanted a travelogue without religion and politics. I don't know. But this removal thing is where our culture is headed, our secular culture, and that's a problem. So, finally, to seek is most important. Never cease seeking. That's what I say. I have to say ultimately about Catholic intellectual tradition in a secular setting, not just the university setting. The divine is never fully grasped, but in the seeking itself that one finds. Sacred space, one hopes, would always be there, waiting for our seeking. But so are unlikely places, in mind, as well as soul, as well as on earth. Emily Dickinson summed it up very nicely. I'll end with her, a non-Catholic. At least to pray is left. O Jesus, in the air, I know not which thy chamber is. I'm knocking everywhere. Thank you for your patience.
I think we have time for some questions.